Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to The Lob podcast from These Football Times. And this mini-series called Icons, a number of the team from TFT Towers will be chatting about players, recent or past, who they consider worthy of being described as true icons on the football world. My name's Gary Thacker, and in this episode, I'm talking with Rob Fletcher again about a different one of his footballing icons. And this is a guy who perhaps some people might not have considered an icon, but for so many reasons, he certainly was. How you doing, Rob?
I'm doing well, Gary. I'm doing very well. I'm very excited to talk about this player as well.
Yeah, I mean, a wonderful player and a guy who I think it was John Holm described as a genius. This boy is a genius. So tell us who we're talking about, mate.
We're talking about Michael Laudrup today. And he's a player who I probably, as a young fan, caught the tail end of his prime, if you like. But, you know, as you get older and you start looking into the past, then you look at sort of the origins of some of these football players, you realise kind of what an impact they had on football and why they were so iconic.
So I guess for some people who are familiar with the name Michael Laudrup might sort of know him as the Danish Dynamite team, the World Cup in Argentina, what a wonderful team they were. And that was obviously that tournament when he was described as... This boy's a genius. But what sort of era are we talking about now? Where are we, the competitions he was in? And he played for a certain number of the biggest clubs in the continent.
Yeah, he really did, actually. And we're kind of spanning the early 80s up to sort of the mid to late 90s. And one of the memories I've got is right at the end of Laudrup's career was the France 98 World Cup when he was back in the Denmark squad wearing oversized letters and numbers on the back of the shirts, that Laudrup 10. And I always remember that. And I remember him from Ajax right at the end of his career. He had a very brief spell at Ajax. And again, part of my football education of reading world soccer was looking at where players were moving and transfers. And you get the little updates from every league world and everything. Yeah. I was like, oh, Michael Laudrup, you know, he's gone to Ajax. But then obviously his career started way before that. And Bromby was the team really where he made his name. Didn't actually spend a long time there because obviously back then most leagues had a one foreign player rule or a two foreign player rule. So actually there wasn't a lot of movement outside of sort of your home nations really. So normally you might play for most of your sort of early 20s, then you would get your big move. But not so much for Laudrup, who moved at a very, very young age to Serie A, which was the sort of premier competition, wasn't it, in Europe at the time. Probably where the most money was, really. He was a very, very young player when he got there. They had two foreign players allowed in your team. So actually, Liverpool were the first team who went in for him and were looking to sign him. But actually, he decided not to. And he went to Juventus. Now, a lot of people think Lazio was the first club he went to, but actually that's the first club he played for in Serie A. But Juventus obviously had Boniek and Platini. So a very young Danish kid who was still a little bit thin and maybe not as world-weary as he became later on, was not going to displace those two from that really great Juve team of that early 80s. But Lazio were not really the side that they are probably in the 90s and the noughties in terms of spending a lot of money. So actually, they got relegated eventually when he was there. Ends up at Juventus. Again, finds it a little bit difficult, but starts to play a little bit more. They win Serie A. They start to sort of get a little bit more success with Laudrup in the side. He gets some injuries. Ian Rush arrives. So again, that's sort of really difficult for him to get in the side because of that. And eventually, probably where he makes his name on the club side is with Barcelona, with Johan Cruyff. And that was a match made in heaven.
It's fascinating. And this is, you mentioned about he's struggling to get through at Juventus because of the players and the restricted players. And this is something that's almost haunted him through his career. And he had some great times at Barcelona, a key member of the Dream Team. But Let's talk a little bit about his time at Barcelona. So obviously, as I say, you said he played under Cruyff there. The success he had, I mean, I guess Laudrup was perhaps the most similar Cruyff-like player in that team, and perhaps that's one of the reasons why Cruyff sort of took him so much.
I think for someone like Cruyff, in the system that he was trying to play, when he got to Barcelona, he almost changes half the squad overnight. They get rid of so many players because he doesn't feel like they can play sort of in that way. So he shifts his focus into players who he thinks he can mould into the sort of 3-4-3, because it was a 3-4-3 back then, really, for Cruyff a lot of the time, more than the 4-3-3 that Rijkaard brings in, Van Gaal, Pep later on. Laudrup is incredibly gifted technically. His touch, his passing, his dribbling, his vision. So actually, he could be sort of marshalling the attack, if you like. And if you ever watch any Barcelona games from that time, and I've been watching a few of them, I've seen highlights because I'm sort of working on stuff for sort of around Cruyff's dream team. When you look at Laudrup, the positions that he takes up, they're not normal on a football pitch. He's not playing wide on the left. He's not wide on the right. He's not in the 10. He's not in the 9. But he's there. He's floating in between positions. He's, you know, in modern football parlance, you'd call it, he plays in the half spaces. He plays in between the 10 and the 11. But you can't pick him up, because does the right back come and get him? Does the central defender come and get him? Does the defensive midfielder come and get him? It's too late. He's already played it in behind your defence with an inch perfect pass for a striker. And that was kind of how Cruyff used him. He was one of the three forwards, if you like, who played almost as like inverted wingers. They had that little bit of freedom to get into the box, but they could control the game, have more of the ball. So actually for Cruyff, Laudrup was such an integral part of the team, but not just from a personnel point of view, from actual playing style point of view. You know, with people in midfield behind him like Baquero, Guardiola, and then even behind that you had sort of Ronald Koeman, then Stoichkov arrives. So many players within that team were so complementary of each other. They all had different skills that all brought the best out of them. But Laudrup was sort of that fulcrum, that heartbeat, that creative, attacking, dynamic force that he'd been for Denmark, probably in 86 in the World Cup as part of that Danish Dynamite team. Now, this Barcelona team weren't kind of built in that style of the Denmark team, but they were exciting and they attacked and they enjoyed playing football. And I wonder if some of the icons that we've talked about through the series, they all enjoy football, don't they? They have that innate joy about that. And I don't know about you, Gary, when you've watched Barcelona, you've kind of, I know you've looked at Cruyff as a player and his time as a manager. That technical ability of Laudrup was just phenomenal. It was just phenomenal.
It was, and I think it's massively underrated because of that. I remember when we had a conversation with Stevie Scragg in another podcast we were doing, and Stevie would say, and it's almost like got a third eye in the back of his head, because he can see things that the players can't see. You know, you mentioned when he played for Denmark, playing alongside a player like Elkjær. I mean, Elkjær must have been, you know, it was like Christmas every day, because he's going to find the through ball. Now he's going to find the through ball. And if he doesn't, he's going to go around a player. And then again, we mentioned, when we were doing the Cruyff one earlier, I mentioned the only player I can think of in fairly modern times that was like Cruyff, that didn't have a step over or dance around. He sort of, like a stream, drifted around players. And Laudrup had that ability as well. And of a similar build to Cruyff as well. Not a big guy, quite sort of, I'll say frail looking, but sort of, you know, certainly not muscular, but he had that ability to float into the down to position, the half space, as you said, and sort of pull players out of position and then deliver the killer pass. That ability to see the pass that would make the difference. And he was such an integral part in the early success of Cruyff's team, wasn't he?
He really was. And I think because Cruyff wanted to play a different style and was probably traditional in Spain, certainly, and at Barcelona as well. He needed somebody who could move the ball from that midfield zone into attack and bring in other players as well, because you've got, you know, your wing-backs coming round you, you've got runners from midfield coming the other side, you've got a striker who's trying to get in behind. The fact that you were trying to manage all of that, like you say, Gary, that sort of third eye, if you like, or that player who can see that. It was almost like he was a playmaker who also happened to have a real eye for goal and was a forward and a dribbler and a winger. He wasn't a playmaker like you would say, and Andrea Pirlo is a playmaker. He was more sort of on the attacking side, almost like an attacking playmaker, maybe you could call him. So again, we've talked on, and there's other players within this series who you can't quite define them by their position, but you had to find a place for them in the team. You had to use their skills in the best way possible to do that. There's a video on YouTube. I think it's about an hour long or an hour and 15 minutes long. And all it is Michael Laudrup passing. And I have to say, I've watched a large part of that video because it's just mesmerizing. Because it's not like how you're watching football. You know, we talk about someone like Kevin De Bruyne in modern football, don't we, as someone who can create, has got an incredible pass, can put it exactly where a player wants it. Laudrup was doing this years ago, 20 years ago. And that little feint, or maybe 30 years ago, actually, isn't it? Never mind, 20.
It would be, yeah.
That little feint that he did, so you were saying there, he wasn't kind of, he wasn't the quickest. He wasn't kind of a wide man who'd beat you for pace. But he had that move where he dropped his shoulder slightly and he'd go past you and you couldn't stop him. And I think that sort of ball skill that he had, that creativity that he had, just meant that he could create all the time. And that Barcelona team who won four La Ligas in a row, they really thrived on that. And when you've got people like Stoichkov in front of you who had the sort of aggression and power, then someone like Laudrup was going to be able to thrive because you could always have him in that sort of withdrawn role. He doesn't have to be the centre of the team. He never really wanted to be the focus in terms of like the celebrity player or whatever. True. He was very kind of humble on the pitch, if you like, but his technical ability was just phenomenal.
I mean, I mentioned earlier for me, the sort of abiding memory of Laudrup is that goal against Uruguay. I think it must have been Uruguay in the World Cup. But I mean, are there any sort of other sort of particular memories of Laudrup that stick out aside from that?
I think for me, it's probably actually when he goes to Real Madrid. So, you know, obviously he's at Barcelona and he's part of Cruyff's dream team. Back end of 93-94, they've now added Romario into the mix. So at this point, obviously it's only a three foreigner rule. So you've got Koeman, Stoichkov and Laudrup. They're kind of the dream team's three players. They've won all these league titles. They've been the heart of the team for Cruyff. And then Romario arrives. So now there's got to be rotation. But you can't rotate Stoichkov with Koeman or Laudrup with Koeman or Romario with Koeman. So Koeman starts. So now there's two slots for three attackers. And if you want to score goals, you're probably going to try and play the best striker, Romario. And then Stoichkov is another one who can deliver. He can attack and score goals. So Laudrup becomes a little bit more of a fringe player. Still plays plenty of games. So he eventually moves to Real Madrid, who, with Laudrup in the team, win the league for the first time in 4 years. So Laudrup actually wins five consecutive titles. But actually, he's part of the team that wins 5-0 in El Clasico in the white of Real Madrid. And it just highlighted everything that Barcelona had lost. When you lose a player like Michael Laudrup, you lose a lot from your team. Yes, you can have Stoichkov. Yes, you can have Romario. But actually what you've lost is you've lost that player who knits everybody together, who ties the attack and the midfield together. And what was Barcelona's loss became Real Madrid's gain. And obviously, there's always a 5-0 knocking around, isn't there? Because Barcelona did it to Real Madrid as well in an El Clasico a season earlier as well. So there's still that within it. But the difference that he made to that Real Madrid team to turn them and make them into sort of champions, I think really was a big loss for Barcelona. So it was a very unpopular move, as Figo found, and obviously Luis Enrique went between the two clubs as well. Very, very difficult move for someone like Laudrup to make. But Cruyff wanted to do it. He wanted to prioritise his other foreign stars, and Laudrup was the one really that benefited.
It's fascinating when you look at that sort of point in time, the European Cup final, Milan. Laudrup's left out. In the season he goes. Cruyff's team starts to fall apart. Laudrup picks up success at Real Madrid. You can't think it's a coincidence, can you really?
Absolutely not. And this is why these players are iconic. Because actually, what they do is they help that team to win and succeed, whatever it is. You know, Guardiola, integral to the team. Koeman, integral to the team. And Stoichkov and Romario. But actually, you need that player who's, like I said before, knitting everything together. Yeah, you know what? He never scored 25 goals a season. You know, he never got 25 assists a season. But actually, his 10 goals and his 10 or 15 assists a season, or whatever it was so crucial to the way that team played that when he goes and when you lose him, I mean, he was 30 when he left. So, you know, if they'd brought someone in who was 23, you kind of think, oh, actually, yeah, maybe that is a sensible thing. You know, we're trying to regenerate, rejuvenate the squad, but you can't replace people like Michael Laudrup. You can't replace one-offs. And that's what I think Barca struggled with until obviously they get Ronaldo, then Van Gaal arrives. They win a little bit, but actually it's probably more towards when Rijkaard arrives later on, when actually you see that Ronaldinho in that sort of Laudrup 10, kind of in between a striker and a midfielder, when they actually really start to truly dominate again. Real have got the Galacticos, but you know, when you've got a player like a Laudrup or Ronaldinho, that's when you're gonna really succeed.
It's one of those sort of classic cases of you don't know what you've got till it's gone. You know, I think Laudrup was a fairly, as a personality, was fairly, you mentioned earlier, you said he was humble, but he certainly didn't project himself as being a big, he didn't have that big star mentality. Whether that's something to do with the Danish psyche, I don't know, but it didn't. And perhaps because of that, he probably doesn't get the acclaim that you know, his talent and his success and the difference he made, as you say, when he moved from Barcelona to Real Madrid, he doesn't get the acclaim that truly deserves, does he?
No, and it's interesting when you listen to other players talk about players, isn't it? Because they will tell you who was the best. And I was looking through things about Laudrup, and a lot of the things that his teammates say about him was nobody could do what he could do. We couldn't find anyone else to replace him. You know, there's few people that could do it. But he didn't have the Maradona streak in him where he'd put the team on his back necessarily. He didn't have that Baggio streak in him, or Platini, or even a Romario type. You know, he wasn't that player. And maybe if he'd have been more selfish, he might have got 20 goals a season or even 30 goals, because he did have a decent goal record for where he played, and he was quite a good finisher. But actually, the skill that he had, the passing ability he had, the vision that he had, supersedes anything like that. But actually, we forget about that, because passing the football is such an integral part of the game. You just think everyone should be able to do it. But actually, when you're really exceptional at that, it does make you stand out. And I think from someone like for Laudrup, you're not going to think of him as a Ronaldo or a Mario or a Maradona or a Pele or Platini. He is probably in that next level down because he was quite selfless. And maybe that's the difference between being a top 10 player in the world and maybe a top 50 player in the world, if you know what I mean.
It's interesting, I guess. And is the difference not so much his performance on the field, but his absence of a personality off it, shall we say? Because some of the players we've talked about in this series and some of the players to come have had big personalities outside of the game. And I think Laudrup was very much a sort of, when he became manager at Swansea, for example, he was quite the sort of not going out in the town to go for a meal with his missus and that sort of thing, and very low-key. And I guess, there again, I'm sure that's perhaps the Scandinavian mentality. But if he'd have been a more of a larger personality outside of the game, or off the pitch, shall we say, do you think he'd have been considered to be at a level perhaps more than he actually was? So he should have been considered as a player.
Yeah, I think maybe. And I think maybe he never had that edge to his game. You know, he was a good competitor and he competed fairly. And I think sometimes that little bit of a dark side might have been missing from him. You know, that little bit of a selfishness of, I'm not going to pass to you, I'm going to shoot. I'm going to take the glory. I'm going to be the one who says, I won us the final, or I won us that cup competition, or I won us the league. It just wasn't part of his makeup. It wasn't part of his DNA. And maybe, like you said, Gary, maybe that's, you know, at the time with Denmark before, I think it was the late 70s, early 80s when they became professional, wasn't it?
Yeah.
National team. So I do wonder if sort of growing up in that environment where football was fun, enjoyable, but it was an amateur sport until it became, you know, professional a few years later. Then instantly they were great, weren't they? So they went from an amateur game to a professional game, and then in 86 you thought, wow, these are not playing football like other European teams. You know, there's such excitement within it. And I wonder if that upbringing maybe, because you could probably say his brother was similar.
Yeah.
His brother was obviously more of a goal scorer. You could maybe more selfish. You know, I think you've got to be selfish to score goals, haven't you? But maybe he was more the other side. But even so, he was still probably quite humble.
I think that's true.
With all the success that he had. So it's that mentality, I suppose, maybe, isn't it?
I think he was, I mean, just thinking about the Danish team as well, he played alongside Elkjær, who was very much a large personality off the field. I remember there's a famous thing when he'd been, I think he was playing at Verona at the time. Well, it might have been Mecklenburg, I remember, but certainly post his playing in Denmark itself. And his manager had heard a rumour that he was seen with two blondes and a nightclub drinking a bottle of whiskey. And he said, no, it's not true. There were three of them. You know, that was Elkjær, and very much like you look back and, you know, when he was playing at Barca with Stoichkov and Romario, they were the big personality guys, and he was quite happy, as you said, to play that sort of, to be humble, play to play second fiddle, to be the sort of supporting role sort of thing. You know, I suppose if he'd be in the Oscars, he'd be best supporting actor rather than the sort of best actor. But that doesn't, well, it shouldn't diminish his iconic status. But I guess in people looking back who weren't contemporary of him won't know as much about him as perhaps they should. Do you think that's right?
I think, Gary, that has absolutely hit the nail on the head, that best supporting actor line. It's perfect, because that's actually what he was. He was just the best supporting actor. You know what I mean? It wasn't just a one-off cameo in a great movie. He was in all the great movies, and he was the best supporting part in all of those. If you know what I mean? He's that kind of person who never actually wanted the lead. You see it, don't you? Like, it's a good analogy of the movies or TV where they're always second fiddle. Then they get the lead role, and it doesn't work.
It doesn't work, no.
And actually, you wonder maybe if Laudrup had become the key man in the side, maybe that dream team wouldn't have worked, because maybe he couldn't have taken on that load of, you know, top goal scorer, personality off the pitch. You've got to do all the press interviews. Because remember, Stoichkov was creating quite a lot of controversy around the team. Koeman certainly wasn't backwards and coming forwards with his sort of opinions. You've got Baquero, who was quite a strong captain as well. Pep's in there, who's kind of Barcelona through and through. Romario arrives later on. Probably when he goes to that Real Madrid side, he is probably one of the stars, but he's older. So he probably doesn't feel the pressure of kind of, I've got to be the best because I'm 22, 23, 24. And he made football look easy. And I actually think he was quite probably an easy personality to get on with. And someone
true.
Who I think was probably brilliant to have in the dressing room. And when you look at, again, as I was saying before, the people who talk about him, they basically say all of my great performances were because of him, because he put it at my feet where I wanted it, on my head, wherever it was, he put it there. He was the one that did it. And maybe, you know, that supporting actor thing, they make everybody else look great, don't they?
Yeah. They do.
Even
they
by
do,
being
yeah.
great themselves.
Yeah. Oh, I'm quite pleased with that. That was a good metaphor to pick out there.
Definitely.
I guess, you know, in a previous episode, we've spoken about Eric Cantona, his personality. And I guess that's almost the yin and yang of these two guys who were very much, one guy was all personality and I won't say he had no personality. That's a ridiculous thing to say. But as footballers go, who self-promotion is important, he didn't really play that game, did he?
Definitely not. And I think when you talk about great footballers, and he's probably never in that conversation.
No.
He probably. I mean, we're not talking about top five, top 10 footballers here. You know, you've got to understand that. But actually, if you watch him play, he's another one who I think actually would have fit in any era. Like, if you look at the style of play he had, he could have played in the old WM formation, you know, the 3-2-5 or the 2-3-5. He could have played in probably the modern era in that 4-2-3-1, behind a striker, coming off the left. Imagine him in Pep's Manchester City now, with the amount of ball that he would get and the players that would be around him. Even a modern Barcelona side, I mean, imagine again, Messi on one side, Michael Laudrup on the other. I mean, what an incredible sight that would have been. You know, he could have fit into any of these great teams perfectly. Like, not one of these teams wouldn't have been better for having Michael Laudrup in it. And for me, that gives him that real iconic status as someone who we should be talking more about, and we should be watching his games back and learning from what he's done.
It's interesting you mentioned about different systems. And I guess he's a kind of player. If you just said his coach, say, OK, I want you to play wide right. I said, OK, boss. They wanted to play a little bit deeper, you know, picking the ball. OK. It'd be that kind of guy who'd do the job wherever he's asked to do. And not only do it well, but do it exceptionally well. But perhaps because he didn't have that sort of large personality, that then gained another ability, another skill set, another something that really brings a player out as iconic that didn't really get recognised.
Yeah, definitely. And I think probably as time goes on, more and more people will come back to him, I think, and he'll be a player that we sort of look back on and maybe reassess. I mean, the fact that Barcelona fans and Real Madrid fans love him, despite him playing for both teams, says an awful lot. Because you, Gary, know in Spain, if you go from one side to the other, that is it, isn't it? That's game over. One side will hate you and the other side will love you. But actually, both sides actually love and respect Michael Laudrup.
And why not as well? Okay, well, that's great. I mean, fascinating chat about, you know, some players some listeners might not have the first thought of as being a key member of this Icon series, but I hope the conversation we've had has persuaded them that, you know, actually, it's a perfectly reasonable call and a great chat, Rob. So massive thanks to Rob for sharing his thoughts on Michael Laudrup and his iconic status. So thanks for listening, and catch us again next time on the Rob Podcast when we'll be discussing another icon of the footballing world. But for now, cheers, goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a Thees Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.